Dr. Daniel Pipes is in town, and such is his eminence, I thought we should speak to him because he's the director of the US-based Middle East Forum. He's one of the world's foremost analysts on the Middle East. He spoke last night at a forum presented by the Sydney Institute called Changes in Radical Islam. He has said before that the real battle in the world today, the real war, is between civilization and barbarism. Given what's going on in Afghanistan, let alone the Middle East, but closer to home, in Afghanistan, I thought we'd talk to Daniel Pipes. He's on the line. Dr. Pipes, good morning.
Good morning, Alan.
Thank you for your time. I think the last time I spoke to you was back in 2004. You were confident then that the war in Iraq would lead to a reduction in terrorism. Is that the case?
That's not one of my more distinguished predictions.
Sorry, I don't mean to embarrass you.
I generally do well, but this was not one of them.
But your argument was, though, that if you could succeed in Iraq, you'd diminish the appeal of militant Islam and that militants would walk away when they saw their cause losing. Is the cause still winning, is it?
The cause is still winning, with one very important exception, and that's Iran. Radical Islam is on the ascent everywhere in the world, including places like Fiji and Uruguay. Everywhere you look, its standing is going up. But the one exception is Iran. And Iran happens, fortunately, to be the single most important country. It was in Iran 30 years ago that the modern era of radical Islam began, and one has hopes that it's there that it will end before too long.
Well, a story this morning that armed gunmen have killed 7 people and wounded 12 at Fort Hood, which is America's largest military base. Without too much information, what nonetheless can we draw from this?
There has been a persistent attempt by Islamists to attack the United States, whether abroad or at home. I don't know if this is one of those cases, but there were five significant terrorist rings that were broken up in the last month within the United States. So this is an ongoing problem.
Yes, I mean, we talked last time about the Iraqi Shiites chanting over and over again, no to America, no to Saddam, yes to Islam. I mean, isn't this really the issue, that to live a fully Muslim life requires living in accord with the many laws of Islam?
Correct, and the many laws of Islam apply not just to personal life, that is say, personal hygiene, the rearing of children, sexual relations, but it also has to do with public life, the rate at which taxes should be assessed, the nature of warfare, who should govern. So to live a fully Muslim life requires that the government be applying Islamic law, and that in turn implies that the leader himself be a Muslim.
Well, okay, on that basis then, what about the significant changes in the demographic composition of countries in Europe and the growing, the escalation in the number of Muslims who will be voting? How big a risk is this?
I believe that the developments now taking place in Europe are of enormous significance to Europe and to the world, and yet are by and large not being noticed. There are demographic changes taking place, as you just alluded to. There are cultural and religious changes taking place. And as I see it, there are three potential outcomes for Europe. One is that the indigenous Christian population and the new Muslim population get along just fine and create a symbiosis. Unfortunately, this cheery outcome has no basis in reality. It's not what's happening, which leaves two other much more likely alternatives. And I can't tell you which one is going to happen, but I think those are the dreary, bleak choices ahead. One is that the pattern of the last 50 years will continue into the future, and that Muslims become stronger, Islamic law becomes applied, and what people call Eurabia will emerge, an Islamic-dominated Europe. The other is that Europeans, indigenous Europeans, will say, enough, we don't accept this, we want to retain our culture, and which I believe will lead to a protracted civil insurrection where there are fights going on and on and on into the future. So neither of those are happy prospects, but I think they're much more likely than the one in which everyone gets along.
Do you see evidence of what I would call a virtual cultural surrender here? I mean, the British Home Office has drawn up a phrase book to help officials talk about terrorism without making any explicit link between Islam and terrorism. And British politicians are talking about Al-Qaeda terrorists instead of Muslim terrorists. We've got an Australian Multicultural Foundation here. The executive director, a bloke called Hass Dalal, says phrases such as moderate Muslim, jihadist, Islamic extremist, Muslim terrorist are too general, and that the phrase war on terrorism is pernicious because it's shorthand for Muslim.
Exactly. And in the United States, we've had the same change with the Obama administration. I call it the war without a name. I never cared for war on terror. It's not accurate. I would call it war on radical Islam, or as you said before, the war between civilization and barbarism. But there's no name at all now. The U.S. government has adopted such extraordinary euphemisms as man-made disasters and overseas contingency operations. Yeah, it has no name. I'm of the belief that just as a physician cannot treat a disease without first identifying it and naming it, so strategists cannot win a war without first identifying and naming the enemy. We are not doing that. We have an enemy that has no name. We don't know who we're fighting. I think that spells much trouble ahead.
The Bishop of Rochester, the Right Reverend Michael Nazir Ali, who in fact left Pakistan to come to England and now is one of the, in the mid-1980s, he converted to Anglicanism at the age of 20, and he's one of the most powerful Anglicans in Britain. But he said that, he's basically argued that Britain has become mired in a doctrine of endless self-indulgence that's brought an explosion in public violence. He says the Christian values have been eroded, and we've created some sort of vacuum into which Islam is able to fill up the gap. Do you agree with that?
I do agree with it, and I also find it extraordinary that it takes someone from an immigrant like Nazir Ali, in particular an immigrant from a Muslim-majority country, who has to point out to the British what their weaknesses are. And those weaknesses are severe. And indeed, of all the Western countries, the UK represents the most advanced country in the direction of Islamization. The British have shown themselves over and over again to be the least likely to stand up for their culture, their way of life, which is really remarkable given the extraordinary history of Britain and the extraordinary things that have been accomplished there. But there's a weakness now there that is dismaying. And in contrast to Mr. Nazir Ali is the Archbishop of Canterbury, who has said publicly a couple of years ago that he accepts the notion that Sharia law will be there in addition or alongside with, or perhaps even replacing. One doesn't know.
See, just coming back to the Right Reverend Michael Nazir Ali, the Bishop of Rochester, many people listening to this program would agree with him when he said that immigrants were welcomed in Britain, but not on the basis of Britain's Christian heritage, to which they would be welcome to contribute, but by the newfangled and insecurely founded doctrine of multiculturalism. Has that been a damaging factor?
That has indeed, but I think deeper than multiculturalism is a lack of sense of pride in one's own culture, one's own way of life. Mm. And I think ultimately whether or not one has that sense of pride will determine the future of one's country.
Yes, well, I mean, I just wonder whether we're not still asleep at the wheel. I mean, we've had people here in recent times in Australia accused of plotting to attack the Holsworthy Army Base, which I was reminded of when we heard about this attack at Fort Hood. And they were rejoicing in the fact that the crippling drought and the Black Saturday fires that killed 170 people were all part of Allah's will, he said, to punish the filthy people of Australia. He said to one of his similarly inclined mates that Australians were already copping it hard from Allah, quote, "Thanks to Allah, we say, bring the trouble, Allah, bring them calamity. When the whole nation's coming down, first the economy comes down, by Allah, factories are shutting down. I've never seen Melbourne like this. Then fire coming to them, no water, the water storage is empty. They're copping it hard, man, thanks to Allah." Now, do we ignore that or take it seriously?
I think one has to take it seriously, and I would start with immigration. I think just as, for example, in the United States, we had an exclusion of communists for some decades, we should now have an exclusion of Islamists. We should not invite into our countries those who despise us and who would wish us this kind of harm. It has to be taken very seriously.
So what are we to make, therefore, of Afghanistan? I mean, Barack Obama, right throughout the course of the election campaign, promised to give Afghanistan the resources it needed. General McChrystal wants another 40,000 troops. We've seen terrorist violence in Pakistan and Afghanistan, bombings designed to kill. What are we to make of all of this when we've got a Nobel Peace Prize winner trying to win a war in Afghanistan?
Yes.
Hey?
Well, I do think that Nobel Peace Prize was in good part intended to constrain Mr. Obama when it comes to Afghanistan or Iran, so that he will remember that he is the recipient of this prize and will not engage in war. He is in a fix because he used Afghanistan as a counterpoint to Iraq. Iraq was the bad war, Afghanistan was the good war, and now he finds that his own party is in close to rebellion, is not inclined to want to increase the troops and to win this war in Afghanistan.
And the consequence of that will be?
If we don't win it, I don't expect we will win it. The key question is not so much Afghanistan, but the impact of Afghanistan on Pakistan, more important country. I believe there are significant resources in Pakistan to resist the Talibanization of the country. But
the risk is they could be eaten up by the Afghan Taliban.
That is the risk.
That's the risk. Gee, it's always good to talk to you. I hope we can talk often.
I look forward to it.
Thank you so much. There's Dr. Daniel Pipes, and he's the director of the US-based Middle East Forum. He is a world authority on issues such as terrorism and the Middle East, but those are sobering observations, aren't they?